You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Janet Eckelman. Janet, thanks so much for being with me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Brainerd, for inviting me.
So, Janet, I'm so excited to talk about your work and what you're doing and your future plans and current projects. So perhaps we should begin with what you're working on now. I know you have a few commissions and other things in the works, and so perhaps you can tell us what's in the works, and also how do you work? Do you have a studio in Manhattan? How do you model and build some of these things? So I guess we could just begin with what are the current projects you're working on, and how do you work on them?
Well, I'm in the thick of a new project that will open in November on the Sunset Strip in West Hollywood, California. There are two new towers being built by SOM, Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, and I've worked closely together with their engineers for the last couple of years to create my first multi-level, multi-form sculpture. So between these two towers, floating in space between about 12 stories, there are multiple forms that move through the air, and we'll be pulling this into place in the middle of November. It's a permanent work made with permanent fibers.
Wow, so that's very interesting, because I know a lot of your work is temporary. So to describe that, and I know this is a difficult thing to describe, and there will be images in this interview too that people can see, How is that built, and are you drawing that now? It's so curious to me how you mock up something like that and work with that. And so for that particular project, before we move on to the others, how is that built and hung, and how do you make a mock up of that?
Well, before I go into the how I mock it up and develop it, let me tell you just a little bit about the content and inspiration of the work. Its title is Dream Catcher, and there are four layers that are pulled tightly into place with tensioned cables made of a very strong fiber. It's actually 15 times stronger than steel, pound for pound, called ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene. And so these dream catcher-like layers are suspended in multiple altitude levels, and we actually poured their attachments into the floor slabs as these towers were being built. So there's this seamless connection. It's as if something is just floating out of the building with almost there's no visible hardware, because it is all embedded in the floor slab where it is out of view. Then I was looking at the brain mapping of dreaming. So during the deep sleep, in the REM sleep, the movement and shape of the brain waves that are being recorded by researchers became my inspiration, and that's how the colored forms that are moving between these buildings at the scale of architecture and an iconic American location like the Sunset Strip. So that is the piece, and the development process was new for us because this is the most complex integration with architecture that we've ever done. So we actually did scale mock-ups of every single form, and there are 13 of them. We worked very closely with SOM. They came to our studio multiple times, and we have developed a custom software package with Autodesk that enables us to model our fiber netted mesh forms in a format that can be shared with engineers and architects. So it enables us to model these physically in physical scale models in our studio, but then to make these digital models that we share with the engineer, and then they run their analysis software, putting the pre-stress tension and simulating wind and all kinds of other issues that need to be addressed by the engineers. Does that help?
Yes,
explain that process?
Yes, it does. And it sounds very exciting, especially with that architectural firm. That must be thrilling to work with them. And how will it look when it's complete? Can you describe it? I know this is very difficult to do, and it's always the challenge in these kind of interviews talking about visual art, but yours, especially because of its large scale and architectural integrations, what will this project that you're working on actually look like, the Dreamcatcher?
Well, there are, if I could show you the mapping of brainwaves, the colors of the mapping were these very vibrant red and purple and blue, and that became part of the language. What's new for my work is that a color can start in one place on the east and change and transmute by the time it moves across 10, 20, 30, 40 feet to the next tower. And when I was looking at other artists who inspire me, I was looking at the painter Elizabeth Murray and how she sometimes will have multiple canvases, but a color might be on the right corner of a panel and then jump to the next panel and be on the adjacent corner. And our eyes naturally want to make a connection between them in the space between. I was also looking at painter like Mirandi and looking at multiple forms within a larger work.
Fascinating. So these large-scale works, I mean, you're pulling from those are kind of compositional elements in painters because there's a composition in a way that the viewer, which, though different than a painting, obviously moves through your work, right? They're looking around, they're walking around. I mean, it's so enormous in most cases that compositional elements like you're talking about are also, I would think, all the more challenging because of how large it is, how far away you are from it, and how the viewer can have, a multitude of angles on it. Correct?
Yes, and it's almost like you could walk into a painting because you literally can walk in and underneath this, and the building actually has a lobby underground with a giant open oculus that you can look up. And so if you get to that point of view, you look up and you see the sculpture lines up, and there's a roof deck bar and restaurant at the top, so you can also look down, and there's even a pool terrace where people can swim and look at a different angle and height. So it's a very immersive artwork that you can experience and is always evolving and changing based on your movement in life.
That sounds thrilling. I can't wait to see that. So before we go on to another work and perhaps talk about two more projects of yours or ones that are in process, how did this begin? It's such an extraordinary form to work with. I mean, there certainly are artists that have worked with light and different ways of working with architecture. But you have a very unique approach that you're using in a number of different ways. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you got started on this as an artist, as a sculptor? What suddenly opened up the doors to you working in this particular fashion, which seems so unique to yourself and to artists?
I can tell you it wasn't planned. In fact, I wasn't a sculptor. I was a painter for about 10 years and applied for a Fulbright to India and packed up all of my special paints and special brushes to go off and create new work. And I had promised the U.S. Embassy to give 3 exhibitions around the country. They rented gallery and museum spaces, and they were waiting for my paintings. And all of my supplies went missing. So there I was with nothing in terms of materials, and I just had to figure something out, and I was in a place famous for sculpture. They had been making the Chola bronzes in South India for 1,000-plus years, so I thought, well, I'll embrace what's here. I started learning to cast bronze using the lost wax method. And as I got closer to the deadline for the exhibitions, I realized I didn't have enough money to even buy the raw materials, the metal, much less to fabricate and ship them. And I just couldn't make them at the scale I needed my forms to be to have that interaction I wanted. And I was taking a walk on the beach. It's a fishing village where I was working. And I was watching the fishermen. They, every night as they finished their day of work, they were bailing these beautiful forms of nets that were mounds on the sand. And I just looked at that in my desperation and suddenly thought, well, that's another approach to creating volumetric form without heavy solid material. And off I was to explore this method. It's been used for thousands of years by human beings to feed ourselves. And
We're talking about, sorry to interrupt, but the fishing nets, the kind that are sometimes, in some countries, I saw it in Sri Lanka, kind of spun around their heads and thrown out, and they're these huge nets, really.
Yes. Awesome. Yes. So it's a technology that wasn't developed for art. It was developed for livelihood, to survive. And within it, it's an incredibly resilient method and structure. When one part of my sculpture, when the diamond mesh, if any node moves, every other node is moved as well. So it is this complex interaction between the entire work. And one of the parts that is very important to me is the sense of interconnectedness. The works are tying into the world around us, and they are then being affected by the forces of nature, like wind. As the wind moves, my sculpture, which is soft, is then moved by it, and it is able to adapt and be resilient. And that, for me, creates this ever-changing, unfolding artwork. It should never be the same, and every time you see it, in different weather, in different light, it should be an unfolding experience. I want my artwork to be like a relationship where it's always showing you something new.
Hmm. And so it was after that. That's very clear how that came about. So after this experience with the nets and your Fulbright, I believe you said it was. What was the first sculpture that you made that was reminiscent of the works you're so known for now and that we're discussing today?
Well, the first piece that brought this fishing net method in sculpture to architecture was in Madrid, Spain, for the largest art fair in Europe, ARCO. I think that was about 2000. And from there, the urbanist redesigning the waterfront in Porto, Portugal, saw it, and he asked if I could create a permanent work for the city at the scale of hundreds of feet, and that was a huge leap for me. I had never made any major sculpture. I had never trained in sculpture or architecture or engineering or anything similar, but I was excited by the prospect, and the first permanent major work for cities opened in Portugal. We installed at the end of 2004, and the piece has now been there more than a decade. Its title is She Changes, and it is about 150 feet across, made of like stripes of red and white knotted diamond mesh moving in the wind.
And so that diamond mesh, did it also have, was it full of color or no? Was that not as colorful as they are now?
Well, it's a very limited in color. The reference really is to that waterfront in Portugal where they have, well, there are smokestacks with red and white stripes. It's an industrial part of the waterfront. And then there are also these historic lighthouses that have red and white stripes. So there are three steel masts holding up a large ring armature And from that, this curving sort of semi-spherical sculpture is softly moving in the wind. And within its center, it pulls up with a different geometry that contrasts with the outer sphere.
I see. Okay. And then and then I imagine after that you began the work kept evolving into some of what you're talking about today, like the project we began talking about at the beginning of this interview.
Yes. The first major works after Portugal were in the United States, downtown Phoenix, Arizona. It's iconic work, Her Secret is Patience. A more recent piece is in downtown Seattle for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, connecting their buildings to one another at a scale that can be viewed from the Space Needle and from the surrounding neighborhoods.
Wow, and so all these things happened after ARCO, and they just did people just become aware of your work at ARCO and other places, and then just start inviting you, or are you consistently applying to kind of public art competitions?
None of these were things that I applied for. So I suppose it's word of mouth. People see artworks, and, you know, I don't quite know how it all happens. There's sort of some fun things I have noticed. If you go onto Google Earth and go to Portugal, there's, I guess, one iconic photo that represents each country at the level of where you pull back to Europe. And the image that represents the country of Portugal is the sculpture that I created there more than a decade ago. So I don't know how it spreads, but it's been a very exciting set of challenges for me as an artist. There are more inquiries than I can do. So the way I make the decision of what to work on is really about how my work can expand with each project. It has to push the boundary of what I have done before, either in its concept and content or in its structure and manifestation. So that's why I'm doing the piece on the Sunset Strip, because I was telling you it's this most complex and seamless integration with architecture on two sides. Another new piece that's coming up, I'm creating the new gateway sculpture for Austin, Texas. And this is a different site than I've ever worked with. It's a very large, long, flat site. And so I'm doing a piece that is close to the ground and is very much part of a landscape, but linear, whereas most of the other works are these volumetric forms suspended up in the air that you go underneath. So that has
And so when you sketch that out, how does that happen, and how does the color also come into it? I'm so curious about how I would think it looks so different when it's done, you know, because you're working on this kind of, I don't know, heroic scale. How do you make a mock-up and also understand what the color is going to be like in the final iteration of it?
Well, those are great questions. If I were welcoming you into my studio, you would see my wall is lined with about 20 to 30 physical mock-ups of this Austin, Texas site, you know, and the mock-ups are a couple of feet, 2-3 feet, you know, a little big for me to hold, and they are made out of string and wire on a board, and we physically print out the site at its scale, and we start to explore how colored line and surface will interact with the site. And then simultaneous to these physical explorations visually, we build 3D models in the computer. And then we also have photographs of the site. So to answer your question of the color, I'm very much focused on the relationship between the art and the color of its environment. as it changes from day to night, and the color of the land and architecture, if it is there. And in this site in Austin, it's quite low and barren and earth-colored. There is grass. And the sky is such a big part of the canvas for my work. So I'm thinking very much about which colors are going to have a certain kind of contrast to the sky. And this may be one of the first pieces of mine where the view from the air, because it's right at the airport as you enter the city or depart from the city, everyone will drive along it for several hundred feet. But even as you fly in, if you're going to South by Southwest, you will see it as you land. So that's a whole new scale for me to think about.
Wow, that certainly is. It's been great talking about your work and these upcoming projects, which I'd love to see when they're done. I know there's one other thing that's in progress now that we can only talk partly about, but perhaps we can speak to that now because you have also a proposal you're working on?
Sure. I have been working with the Smithsonian American Art Museum. They premiered a new commission of mine this past year at their newly renovated and reopened Renwick Gallery for a show called Wonder, together with some colleagues that I admire and respect very much, with Maya Lin and Leo Villarreal and Tara Donovan. And that piece that I created for them was just announced to be acquired by their permanent collection. And I'm working with them. They are submitting a proposal to have the U.S. representation at the Venice Biennale in 2019. And they've asked me to develop a proposal for creating art for the U.S. Pavilion. And, of course, I wouldn't want to let anything be easy, so I've also proposed that this should include additional site or sites out in the city of Venice. So it would be creating an artwork not only to fill the pavilion, but also to go out into the airspace of this incredible city.
Wow, so for an artist, I would think, and I know we can't get too much more into this because obviously it's a proposal and we'll see what happens, but just to be in the running for something like that, I know different museums propose different artists to the State Department for possibly being the representative of the United States. I mean, of all the things that have happened in your art career, I would think this is a peak experience or regardless of the outcome of it. Just being asked for a proposal is quite a group of artists to be in.
Well, it's terrifying, but exciting. And there's nothing like a challenge to really push me to my edge artistically. So these are the kinds of experiences an artist dreams of.
It's so exciting to hear about that, and I'm glad we got to talk about that a little bit.
I'll be there on Wednesday making a site visit in Venice with my engineer to develop the specifics of the proposal. So your interview comes at an appropriate time.
Ah, that's exciting. Well, have a great trip. I mean, it doesn't seem much has gone into the airspace of Venice quite that way, although I certainly don't know them all, but I know that the Starn twins did that big bamboo project, which I think it was part of a biennial. They certainly weren't representing the country, but I don't know if you know that one, where they did a lot of bamboo lattice work that was on the top of a building. But that's so exciting.
I love their project in New York.
Right, it was the same one, the one that was on top of the Met, very similar. So we'll have a great trip to Venice. That's thrilling. Before we go, I wanted to ask what kind of books you're reading now, which is something I've been asking people lately. It could be anything off-topic, blogs, or anything at all, if you don't mind answering that.
I just received a new book that's just been published called Poems About Sculpture, with a foreword by Robert Pinsky, the U.S. Poet Laureate. And it's this little volume. It's sort of the size of my outstretched hand, my palm, and it's just full of the, you know, different centuries of poets writing about sculpture, from, you know, Rainer Maria Rilke to William Blake, and it includes these new poems by Robert Pinsky, including one he wrote about my sculpture in Boston, which is called the Sky Sculpture. So it's very exciting to see different fields interacting with one another. I should mention that this Saturday I will be giving a lecture at the Pace Gallery in New York. So if there is interest in that, people can reach out to my studio for details.
Terrific. And that's this coming Saturday, which is September 24th, I believe.
Yes.
Very good. I want to thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure and an honor, and I wish you great success and hope to see you in Venice sooner or later. And thank you so much for this talk.
Thank you for this lovely interview.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.